All right, it literally just switched to 9:15 on my computer here. So we're gonna get started presenting here from the University of Michigan. I have our fellow, Will Perry, who is also going to be presenting today. I'm proud of him for taking this on so early in his fellowship. So kudos, Will. So just a brief introduction, this month's cases reflect the June 2022 articles. In these, I identified 13 original articles, one case report and one letter that kind of serve the purposes of our group here. Before moving on to our discussion articles, I'd like to kind of take a brief look at some of the articles not selected for detailed discussion. You know, I'm not going to go ahead and share my screen right now just because I think Will be in a minute. So if you could just turn your attention to the articles for notation, page 8. The second one listed here, prognostic and predictive value of newly proposed grading system of invasive pulmonary adenocarcinoma in Chinese patients, a retrospective multi-cohort study in Modern Path. I think this one was just interesting. I didn't select it, though I thought hard about it. In this article, the authors looked at the IASLC Pathology Committee's proposed grading system for invasive adenocarcinomas. It's based upon predominant subtype and kind of the percentage of high-grade patterns present. They looked at that in 926 cases of clinical stage one lung adenocarcinomas, and they found that kind of this correlated the grade three tumors had worse recurrence-free survival and overall survival compared to lower grade tumors. And they also found that this grading scheme may have value in selecting patients who may undergo treatment with adjuvant chemotherapy. That's clinical stage 1B. And really those patients that were graded originally as grade two based on predominant pattern, but upgraded to grade three using the new system. So I thought that this was interesting and something to keep an eye on for the future. Another article of interest that I just kind of found interesting, always because I think it's funny when radiologists are trying to be pathologists. We still, this is an article in Radiology on page 9, the CT-based radiogenomics analysis of clinical stage 1 lung adenocarcinomas with histopathologic features and oncologic outcomes. For now, we still have a job. That's the take home. But like I said, for now, they did a pretty good job in stratifying patients based on the presence of aggressive features. Also want to mention, there was an article in Lung Cancer about PD-L2 expression in lung adenocarcinomas. Rest assured, you're not going to be hearing a lot about PD-L2, at least right now. It showed no prognostic significance. And then I just want to give a shout out to the authors of the case report out of Japan. This is published in Histopathology, and these authors were able to nab the cover with their very cool images of coronavirus hunted in human pneumocytes and alveolar macrophages. So check that out if you have a moment. So without further ado, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Will Perry for his first article for discussion. Will?
Hey, good morning, everyone. I'm gonna go ahead and share my screen, and this, if you have it pulled up, this will look familiar. I thought this was an interesting topic. I have a somewhat short background in epidemiology, so these kind of topics with a lot of exposure history and trying to figure out pathophysiologic findings behind those interests me. But so this was a study where they looked at injury to particularly focused on small airway disease in people who were deployed into military engagements in particularly in Southwest Asia. So this would be I'll get into their group in a minute here, but the main purpose here was to characterize the overall histopathologic findings in lung biopsies from these patients who had persistent respiratory symptoms following their deployment. and compared those to findings from both normal lung tissue. So that for that, they used unused donor lungs, and then from patients with other diseases that are known to affect small airways. And I'll show you what they used as their comparison down here. So what they did was they went through their records and reviewed patients who were being evaluated for unexplained exertional dyspnea following military deployment between 2001. So that would have been when in the US our military deployments were ramping up in Iraq and then later Afghanistan through 2017. And they identified patients who underwent tissue sampling for that unexplained exertional dyspnea. So they had 65 patients total in that group, 63 of whom had surgical lung biopsies, one had a lobectomy, and then one had a cryobiopsy. And then what they did there is they collected their basic demographic information, asked them about smoking history, and then collected self-reported exposure frequency to a number of exposures. And those included sandstorms, smoke from burn pits, and then diesel exhaust particulates and combat dust from mortar fire. And just to clarify how many people had those, so 35% had significant sandstorm exposure. They consider that medium to high sandstorm exposure, so a couple times a week. And then 90% had significant exposure to burn pits, 98% to high diesel, so virtually everyone was exposed to diesel exhaust. And then 55% had significant exposure to combat dust from mortar fire. Then they identified their comparison group. So like I said, that was unused donor lungs, and then patients with chronic hypersensitivity pneumonitis, respiratory bronchiolitis alone, and then post-transplant or autoimmune obliterative bronchiolitis. And then what they did is just, they had a single pulmonary pathologist who was blinded to the original diagnosis, use a scoring system that they developed for a number of histologic abnormalities. So they'd go through and rank those on their severity. They scored those in all cases, including the normal lungs. And they used separate scoring for each site biopsy. So each different lobe got its own score. And what they found, so they're first going over the actual population here. Of course, the people who were deployed, the 65 patients who fit into the deployer category, they call them, were overwhelmingly male, as we would expect. And they're younger on average than the other groups. Only 3% were current smokers, but 40% had a history of smoking. So that is higher than what we'd expect, you know, in the general population in terms of former smoking status. In their comparison groups, those had lower smoking percentages, and there was a lot of missing data there for them as well. And then the vast majority of cases here, both for the deployers and all their comparison groups, had upper and lower lobes available for evaluation. So what they found in these groups was that, and I'll focus on the deployers primarily here, overwhelmingly they had lymphocytic bronchiolar inflammation as well as pleural lymphocytic inflammation. Those were about 90% each. And then about 2/3 of the deployers showed smooth muscle hypertrophy and peribronchiolar metaplasia. Also interesting, they had both bronchiolar and interstitial granulomatous inflammation in just under half of the cases, and moderate to severe emphysema in just under half of the cases. And a substantial subset of those with emphysema were in the non-smoking group, the never smokers. All of the scored abnormalities, and I'll show you those, I'll show you the table two, were present in at least a subset of these deployer tissue biopsies. Although findings like lymphoid follicles in any compartment, pleura, or adjacent to small airways in the interstitium, lymphoid follicles in general were not that common, nor was organized pneumonia. Both of those were in 10% or less of cases. And then in terms of the distribution, upper versus lower lobes, the small airway injury actually tended to be a little bit predominant in the lower lobes. So I'll switch over to this, and I'm assuming you guys can still see my screen here, right?
Yes.
Cool. Yeah. In terms of the deployers, what I went over just there was overwhelmingly they do have a lot of lymphocytic inflammation that was a common finding in the airways and then in the pleura as well. And then smooth muscle hypertrophy and peribronchial metaplasia were also common. And you can see here their comparison groups. So the lymphocytic and pleural lymphocytic inflammation and the bronchiolar, it is different from normal lungs. They have these clearly, based on the number of abnormalities and the frequency of some of those abnormalities, they can clearly be distinguished from normal lungs in these cases. Where it gets a little more difficult, at least based on my interpretation of the data, was comparing it to things like chronic hypersensitivity pneumonitis, because in a substantial subset of these deployer patients, you'll see granulomatous inflammation, it tends to be either in the interstitium or in the adjacent to the airways. Also, in their down here to their figure, you can see in figure 6 here the distribution of each abnormality by the lobe. So blue is going to be our lower, green is the upper, and then of course orange right in the middle. So the inflammation, the injury in the small airways, as I said, did tend to be a little bit lower lobe predominant, but you'll still find it in the majority of upper lobes as well. But if you have to choose just one site in terms of a place where you want to assess these abnormalities, the lower would be your best bet. So overall, my interpretation of this was that the lung tissue from this patient population who were deployed, they frequently show this lymphocytic bronchiolar and pleural inflammation, peribronchiolar metaplasia, and occasionally have granulomas inflammation, indicating that they may have significant histologic overlap with hypersensitivity pneumonitis. And in general, these biopsies do display a wide variety of histologic abnormalities that are primarily indicative of small airway and airspace injury, but are somewhat nonspecific when you start comparing them to other lung diseases.
Nice job, Will. So I have some comments, or if anyone would be interested in commenting on this, please go ahead. I think for me, what stands out most is kind of where there's information gaps here, where I would want more information. What other exposures do these patients currently have, or these individuals? And kind of there's this lack of data with autoimmune, so I think that lots of gaps here, really a descriptive study, but I want more information certainly before I make any conclusions based on this. Did anyone have any comments?
Did they describe any silicotic features in these patients?
Not that I saw in this paper. I don't think there's any mention of any type of silicotic nodules or anything resembling that. It could be in the supplemental table. There's a pretty long supplemental table that I could take a look at.
I have a question. I may have missed this, but do you know the timeline from this exposure for these patients? Are they presenting earlier or more in a subacute matter? I don't know. I mean, when the cryobiopsies were taken, I'm just curious about that.
So within, they don't get into the specifics of on average how long it was from the time of presentation to the time of biopsy, or how long the symptoms had been going on here. So that is, again, that's another pretty critical piece of clinical information that's missing.
Is this from the group of Vanderbilt University?
No, it's from Colorado.
Okay, thanks.
All right, so to be continued. All right. Moving on to our second article for discussion. I'm going to go ahead and share my screen. Let's see. We have here this article of the Journal of Clinical Pathology. This very lengthy title: does histological assessment accurately distinguish separate primary lung adenocarcinomas from intrapulmonary metastases, a study of paired resected lung nodules in 32 patients using a routine next generation sequencing panel for driver mutations. I selected this because I always think that it's interesting to look at how good we are kind of when we're making these assessments and an inter-observer agreement. I think it's really interesting, particularly in the context of kind of this pattern-based approach to lung adenocarcinomas. This paper is out of Cleveland Clinic. It looks like Carol Farver was one of the authors, which she was here at Michigan, but as you all know, she's back at Cleveland Clinic now. So really their goals in this kind of reflected in their title were to look at, you know, how good we are at deciding relatedness, which is important based on for our T staging, particularly when we're talking about intrapulmonary metastasis, you know, grading these independently, or are they a T3, T4, or even M1 disease? So that was really the drive. So their purpose here was to assess how good we are at doing it and using kind of the molecular testing as the determining factor for relatedness. So what they did was identify adenocarcinomas from patients with two resected lung nodules at Cleveland Clinic over about an 11-year period. They excluded lung nodules in which both nodules were in the same lobe. They worried about the possibility of sampling of the same nodule twice. So they just took those cases out of the mix. So these are nodules in separate lobes of the ipsilateral side or contralateral lung. So the slides from paired tumors were independently reviewed by three pathologists who are blinded to all data. Although not specifically stated, I think that it was all tumor slides. They didn't mention that it was just a representative slide from each site. They reported whether they thought that tumors were related or unrelated. So just kind of a binary yes or no. And then there was also analysis of patterns, nuclear grade and present and extent of mucinous features. It was a little unclear to me if all of the pathologists were doing that or just one, simply when we're looking at one of the tables coming up, kind of where that information came from, or maybe it was the original pathology report, it's unclear. So the molecular testing was performed on all tumors, and the determination of relatedness was based upon if they're unrelated, there were different driver mutations, or there was one driver mutation and one wild type. They thought that they were unrelated. Related if the same low frequency driver mutation. And they said they couldn't figure it out. If it was the setting of they're both wild type, or they both have identical high frequency driver mutations, or in some cases, a driver mutation was present in one tumor, but the other tumor hadn't been tested for that mutation. So understandably, they couldn't decide in that setting. So 32 paired cases were identified. So they reviewed 64 tumors. Looking at table one, this is what I was referring to, where it was a little unclear to me where this information came from the histologic patterns. So what this is here, they have the percentages. So MP would be micropapillary 80%. And as you can see, kind of they gave these, they reported these for each of the tumor types. And then here in the third column, you have the assessment of relatedness, related versus unrelated. In cases in which there was a discrepancy between the three reviewers, that occurred in six cases, so about 18% of the time, there was an agreement in interpretation of whether they're related or unrelated. For the analysis, they went with the majority opinion in those cases. So interesting, just even that information, six of the cases, even experts didn't agree. Looking at table two, I think this one is very interesting. It's a little hard to look at on its own, so I went ahead and highlighted portions of that. So table one details the result, or excuse me, table two details the driver mutations and determination of molecular relatedness. Eight cases were indeterminate. That's the pink highlights here. And the reasons for those, four of those were high frequency mutations, two were wild type, two mutations not tested in one tumor. So I think in the end, and as they have in their discussion, in that scenario, you rely on the histologic assessment, you know, and maybe other clinical data that's present to decide whether or not these are related. In four cases, those highlighted in yellow, there was a discrepancy between the author's histologic assessment and the molecular results. So looking at this here, we're gonna look at this in more detail in a minute. It's worth pointing out that in the original pathology report, the original pathologist reported those as unrelated. So kind of this discrepancy occurred. Why is that? Because the original pathologist was privy to information that these individuals didn't have. As you recall, they were practicing blindly. So in highlighting another important point. So figure two, I think this is a very interesting figure, really important one here for this article, is looking at, it reflects the accuracy of histologic assessment in the context of the molecular findings. So importantly, no cases deemed as unrelated by histology were found to be related by molecular testing. So the here's our unrelated and zero were found to be related. So really good job at deciding, okay, these look different. These are not related, and molecular is confirming that. And here, this just illustrates what I already mentioned above, that of the 15 paired tumors thought to be related, four of those were actually found to be unrelated. Interestingly, six were related and five were indeterminate due to kind of those, as I already mentioned, high frequency mutations or others. So of the 20, of the four cases thought to be related on histology, found to be unrelated by molecular testing, here's kind of taking a deeper dive into those. The reasons that, the authors thought that these were misinterpreted were that really similar kind of percentages of the subtypes that, so kind of the predominant patterns being similar, and all of these cases were non-mucinous or mixed. As I already mentioned, two cases were correctly staged by the original pathologists because they are aware of the molecular test results prior to sign out. So fortunately, we mostly, or hopefully don't kind of practice in a vacuum, and we have that data available to us as well, although sometimes it doesn't feel that way. Looking at figure four, just one last one I'd like to point out. Here's a figure that reflects the overall survival. And they found that there's no difference in overall survival between patients with intrapulmonary metastasis and biologically unrelated tumors. So it may lead you to think, what does it matter? I think it matters still, but this kind of figure doesn't maybe reinforce that. So I think that the take-home points from this paper are, if two tumors look different and you think they're unrelated, then you're almost certainly correct. The authors did a good job of illustrating that or making us feel that way. However, use caution when tumors are morphologically similar in a patient with no other evidence of disease to suggest metastasis. You might consider performing molecular testing to decide if these tumors are truly related. You may be forced to fall back on histology, which occurred in some of these cases, and maybe it wasn't really that much of a question, but you don't want to be wrong in this case, and you don't want to overstage the patient and overtreat the patient. So with that, if anyone has any comments, I can stop sharing. Not on this one.
I was just curious across people's practices, whether they just, if you have a resection specimen and you have multiple non-mucinous adenocarcinomas, did the clinicians demand molecular testing or what everybody's go-to practices nowadays?
At least in my experience, it seems that our tumor boards, they, you know, if we say that they look different, they trust us in that. I have to admit, I'm going to be, I may change my practice a little bit in the way in which I report these or I'm talking about these when I think that they're related, because our clinicians, I don't feel like, are demanding it. How about you?
Our volume is low enough that it hasn't really come to the fore yet, but I think these are interesting findings.
Yeah, me too. It made me nervous. So,
this is Yingqing. So at the Mayo Rochester, I think the clinician kind of follow what pathologists call on the pathology report. And Arizona, I think they start to send more of those like two nodules, because I see many cases show two nodules sent for sequencing at the same time. So I think their practice is a little bit different. They tend to send sequencing.
That's interesting. Yeah, so the oncologists are kind of following our lead, it sounds like, in most of the cases. In the paper, kind of they navigated that in their discussion, that the drawback, you know, kind of it would be, you know, how we report these cases then if we want to send something for sequencing. Just kind of sign out the region or a. So I think that would be something to discuss with the clinicians if ever making a change in our own practice.
Did you get a sense from the paper? I didn't have time to dissect it in terms of whether there was bias of treatment in terms of you. I had mentioned one of their conclusions was that the intrapulmonary mets and asynchronous tumors behaved similarly. And I don't know if they delved into it in terms of kind of selection bias of whether people were treated differently or what have you.
I didn't notice that they did that. It was interesting. In one of their supplementals, I updated the version I had from what I originally uploaded to the version with all the supplemental data. Some of these patients, I mean, that they were saying were unrelated, I mean, and died of having another tumor, that seems like a lot of these patients had pretty poor clinical outcomes. Just so maybe it's the patient population. Of a novel mesothelioma weighted grading scheme. So what the authors did here is they examined the reproducibility and prognostic value of the four main grading schemes for diffuse pleural mesothelioma. And that's really those listed here. That's the kind of 2012 Kadota scheme, just using nuclear grade, then the 2018 Rosen paper in Modern Path, these two different schemes, and then the WHO two-tiered system, which is kind of right now regarded as the gold standard, and they wanted to compare these. And then with that information, they proposed a novel grading scheme that they wanted to be applicable for risk stratifying patients regardless of histologic subtype and BAP1 status, which they show are kind of gaps in these other grading schemes. So what they did is they retrospectively reviewed all cases of diffuse pleural mesothelioma where the tissue block was available and adequate over a 30-year period. They looked at the patient demographics and all causes of death recorded A major limitation of this study is that staging and treatment data are not available, and they navigate this in their discussion, though I don't think that it maybe greatly impacts their kind of data. For each case, one representative H&E stained section was independently reviewed by three separate pathologists who are blinded to all data, and these I'm sorry, are you guys there? There, I lost everyone.
We're back again.
Okay.
Yeah, we're back again.
All right, I was like.
I think we're back.
All right, sounds good. All right, so where was I? Okay, so they looked at all these parameters and then they performed BAP1 on all cases. So they identified 369 small biopsies, and they indicate small biopsies because they do not perform extrapleural pneumonectomies at their institution. So relatively small samples in each case. Of these 369 cases, 299 patients had died during the follow-up period. So table two just kind of reflects the clinical and pathologic characteristics of this group. They performed univariate analysis on this information and found that age greater than 74, a non-epithelioid histology retained BAP1 expression, mitotic count greater than 5 in about 10 high power fields, the presence of necrosis and severe nuclear atypia were all significantly associated with worse overall survival. They then performed multivariant analysis, which showed that all variants correlated with overall survival except for mitotic counts. Then they go on to look at the different types of how well each of the scoring schemes performed. So these are the Word documents that I uploaded in a separate folder on the share drive. This is the 2012 nuclear grading scheme. It worked to stratify the patients. You can see here in figure 1A, you can see them separated out here. But when they further stratified this according to subtype, this grading scheme only held up for the sarcomatoid and biphasic cases. Everywhere else, it did not hold up in the other settings. Looking at the five-tiered grading scheme, I think that this is a nice way to look at the data. Just kind of shows that there's no rank ordered hierarchical relationship between advancing grade and overall survival for this five-tiered grading system, which takes into account nuclear grade and the presence of necrosis. Looking at going back to figure two, this is using the WHO grading scheme, which shows that that this stratifies the patients according to low and high grade for survival. But when you look at the different subtypes, it holds up as showing prognostic significance in the epithelioid and biphasic cases, as well as when BAP1 is lost. That's what they mean by BAP1 negative, BAP1 lost. But the WHO scheme for grading into low and high grade does not stratify patients in the settings of pure sarcomatoid cases or when BAP1 is retained. And then finally, the mitotic index and necrosis grading scheme. Oopsies, wrong one. that was not applicable in the settings of sarcomatoid variants or when BAP1 was retained. So no scoring system worked in all settings for all subtypes or all BAP1 status. So none is perfect. So that really was their drive to create this weighted grading scheme that takes into account kind of histologic parameters that were in some shape or form being evaluated in the other grading schemes, but also adds in BAP1 and patient age. So that's kind of detailed here in table three. I think that figure three is reflective of the fact that, so this puts them into three tiers, a low grade, intermediate, and high grade. It separates out based upon median survival. That's what's illustrated here in figure 3A. I really thought this was impactful, however, figure four, that shows that there's this progressive increase in score correlates with worsening survival as kind of you get more parameters scored here. And it's just this, I thought that was really impactful, figure four. If you wanted to make this a more tiered grading system rather than the three tiers that they propose, it still separates out. So this is just another way of looking at that data. As far as inter-observer agreement, there was good inter-observer agreement overall, but the assessment of nuclear grade was poor. And so that was one area where they felt like if there was any education that needed to happen as far as pathologists, that would be the area that there's not very good understanding of nuclear grade. The take-home messages were that the authors achieved their stated goal of creating a weighted grading scheme that stratifies patients regardless of histologic subtype and BAP1 status. And this seems like it should be easy to implement. I think that the one potential drawback is that you would need to perform BAP1 on all of your cases. So with that, I will stop sharing and we can discuss this or open it up for discussion if anyone has comments. All right, well, this was in Dr. Churg's American Journal of Surgical Pathology. So I thought that that was in and of itself spoke to maybe kind of his impressions of this and something to be aware of for the future. So to be continued, I suspect. Our final article for discussion is really, you know, the reason I selected this was just to put it more on our radar than perhaps it would have been if it was an article for notation, because I thought that this was certainly something for that I want to be aware of and I'd want to make you aware of as well. So this was published in the American Journal of Surgical Pathology. This comes from Churg and Company, a new immunohistochemical stain. UHRF1 separates benign reactive spindle cell mesothelial proliferations from sarcomatoid mesotheliomas. So their purpose, their stated purpose, was to evaluate the use of this immunohistochemical stain in separating benign from malignant mesothelial proliferations. I made these kind of their secondary aims up here, kind of based on what they navigated in their article. These weren't specifically stated by them, but they did also investigate if there was a relationship between UHRF1 percent positivity and the loss and or retention of BAP1 and MTAP. And they also assessed if this stain is helpful in separating sarcomatoid mesothelioma from sarcomatoid carcinoma, which, you know, I'm sure you find that a challenge in your practice as we do here at Michigan. So this is a nuclear stain, and they created a dual stain, and that's what you're seeing here. The cytokeratin is staining in pink, and the UHRF1 is the brown chromogen here. What they did was they applied this immunostain to tissue microarrays. That was kind of step one look at tissue microarrays, see where there may be utility in this stain. They stained 29 benign epithelial mesothelial proliferations, 11 benign spindle cell mesothelial proliferations, 39 epitheliid mesotheliomas, and 22 sarcomatoid mesotheliomas. And then based on kind of this initial screen, they went on to apply the immunostain to whole sections of organizing pleuritis and sarcomatoid mesotheliomas. And of those sarcomatoid mesotheliomas, some of those were desmoplastic mesotheliomas. Then they used a TMA to stain 18 sarcomatoid carcinomas. Pretty simple what they did. They just did they counted the nuclear staining in keratin positive cells, and BAP1 and MTAP stains were performed on the TMAs only. So table one details the TMA screening results for UHRF1. And I failed to mention. So they did a dual stain because they found that the nuclei of kind of endothelial cells and other cells were also staining with the UHRF1. And so they wanted to be able to specifically score the mesothelial cells. Sorry, I failed to mention that before. So in this screening data, they found that although significantly significant, there was a lot of overlap between reactive epithelial proliferations and epithelioid mesotheliomas. So that's kind of well illustrated here. There's just way too much overlap. And so they felt like this couldn't be diagnostically useful. You know, no one was going to be able to use this to interpret, even though it was statistically significant. On the other hand, there was a broad range of staining for sarcomatoid mesotheliomas. You can see that spread here. This is in the TMA data. And using a 10% cutoff in this data, they found that the sensitivity and specificity for sarcomatoid mesotheliomas was 76 and 100% respectively. So they felt that this was useful and that they could actually do something with this. So they went on to apply this stain to the whole stained slides. And that showed that with a cutoff of 9.3, so about 10%, it was 100% sensitive and specific. They found that there was no relationship between UHRF1 staining and loss or retention of BAP1 or MTAP in sarcomatoid mesotheliomas. And they found that almost all sarcomatoid carcinomas showed such a high fraction of staining that this marker wasn't helpful at all in this scenario. So it's just a cancer stain. It's not helpful in differentiating meso versus carcinoma. So I think the take-home message is that you may consider adding a UHRF1 really in the setting of probably a dual stain to your immunohistochemical lab to aid in differentiating benign from malignant spindle cell mesothelial proliferation. So I thought this was something that I was worth drawing your attention to and something to consider. So with that, we have 2 minutes left. Are there any final comments?
Did they compare this stain to MTAP head to head? Or any of the other benign versus malignant stains?
No, they didn't. They were really looking at how they compare or if there was any correlation between them. They felt that because it was 100% sensitive and specific, it was better than the other stains. All right.
I just get nervous looking at the pictures and the endothelial cells staining. It's hard enough to figure out what cells are what. It's.
I couldn't agree more. So while they make it look beautiful, I'm not sure if in practicality it's quite as useful. And I'm sure a lot of cases fall into that gray zone, particularly looking at that spread. So really positive, helpful, but I don't know if you would even need the stain in that scenario. You know, maybe a keratin stain or an H&E would answer that question. So, and probably in this setting of the difficult cases, that's when I imagine it could be lower and more difficult to interpret. But Anyhow. All right, everyone have a great week. Thank you for joining today. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Thank you. Good day.
Thanks.